This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Progressive Radio News Hour. I had no idea I was doing a doubleheader today. A repeat of yesterday's program with Jack Rasmus. I thought that voice sounded familiar. And then when that second voice came, I said, oh my goodness, I think I know that guy. Oh, I better know that guy. I wake up with him every morning. It's me. Anyway, Ellen Brown is on today. Oh, it's always great having Ellen on for the few people who don't know who she is. She's a civil litigation attorney, an author, a frequent writer on financial issues. Her newest edition of her absolutely fabulous book, You Have to Buy Web of Debt and Read It. New edition is coming out in days, so I know you can order it now. And I say unreservedly, it is a brilliant analysis of the private banking cartel Federal Reserve, how it usurped money creation power, and how we can take it back. So it's no surprise to me that the Daily Bell, the compendium of free market thought, awarded Brown her own title, saying in modern economic thought, there are now Keynesians, Austrians, and Brownians. I do love that quote, Ellen. Welcome. Welcome back.
Thanks, Aaron. Great to talk to you.
Have you got an official debut date for the new edition?
I was told it was next week. So
sometime next week. Close enough. Oh, it would have been great to have you on the day it came out. We could pop the champagne corks together.
Uh-huh. It would be, yes. Thank you.
Oh, my goodness. We want to talk about your latest writing. And I always love talking about state banks and how important they are, state-owned banks, not banks that happen to be located in states, but state-owned banks. Unfortunately, there's only one. But there are rumblings beneath the surface. It takes a long time to get change, the kind of change we really want, Ellen. But your second article is great, too. Let's talk about the first one and the second one. I love the title, Student Loans. The government is now officially in the banking business. Well, it was there all along, but now it's got it 100% for student loans. But your other article, The Growing Movement for Publicly Owned Banks, I think this is awfully important. Talk about that, Ellen.
When I wrote that article, there were I wrote an article a month earlier about the growing movement for publicly owned banks, in which I noticed said that there were seven candidates in seven different states who were proposing state-owned banks as a way to solve the fiscal or their credit crises of their states. And in a mere month, and then there was one state that had a bill pending, and in a mere month, three more states came up with bills, and now there's yet one more. So there's actually five states with bills pending for state-owned banks as a way to get credit moving again. And all of them are taking their inspiration from North Dakota, which is the only state currently to have its own state-owned bank. It is also, I started writing about state-owned banks or that possibility about a year and a half ago, and at that time there were four states that were able to meet their budgets, and then there were three, and then there were two, and now there's only one, and that's North Dakota. the last to go was Montana, and they will meet their budget, but they'll have to do it by slashing services so that they don't actually have enough money, in other words, to do what they want to do. Whereas North Dakota is still talking about what to do with their surplus and whether to cut taxes and so forth. So,
isn't that amazing?
They're in this unique
position. 2009, I guess, as bad as it was for all the other states slashing budgets dramatically, Oklahoma, North Dakota had the largest budget surplus in its history.
Astonishing. I know, it's unbelievable because they have not been trapped in this Wall Street credit freeze. And they set up their bank in 1919 for that very reason, that they were losing their farms to the Wall Street bankers. And so they wanted to keep their money and their credit in state. They didn't want to be beholden to this out-of-state credit engine. The Wall Street bankers were connected to the railroads, were connected to the granaries. It was all one cartel. And the granaries weren't taking their grain when actually they thought the grain was perfectly good. There are two movies on this. And so these farmers, who were actually very independent and had no interest in organizing, they were not interested in any sort of socialist movement, finally realized that they were being defrauded by these by the banks. And so they did organize, and they called it the Nonpartisan League. It's actually a very conservative state. It's a Republican state. And they prevailed and got this bank set up in 1919, and they've been going strong ever since. And in fact, you can make an argument.
Oh, I'm sorry, Ellen. North Dakota's success has got nothing to do with it. It's a small state. I mean, the population is far smaller. The population is about the size of a couple of big Chicago suburbs, about 600,000 people. But
yeah.
It's got nothing to do with that, because the larger the state, the more assets it has or potentially has. So any state can do what North Dakota does.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Ellen, the train is it hasn't left the station, but we can hear the engine purring up just a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm amazed that all these bills just appeared. It's just it's the grassroots, and that's what happens when ideas get out there, and then the grass just starts moving. And it's that old thing about first they laughed, then they oppose you, and then they say that's what I said all along. And people just realize that it's just obvious, and then it just takes off. The one objection to this is that it's a socialist type of thing, but actually, as we can see in North Dakota, because they are not socialist, they're Republican, it's more of a states' rights thing. In other words, it's more of a something on the right than the left, or it's both. You could see it as both, because it's the ability of the state to become self-sufficient and to break away from Wall Street, which we see is the federal government right now. Wall Street owns Congress, and the only way we're going to escape that is to set up our own banks that aren't dependent on Wall Street or Congress.
Oh, absolutely, Ellen, and I'm working on an article on financial reform, the Bonnie Frank bill that passed the House in December, and the Dodd bill in the Senate that passed the Senate Banking Committee on a party line vote, and now it'll go to the House, to the Senate floor for debate. I mean, and they just rammed it. They just rubber stamped it in committee, and I think that there wasn't very much debate, and now to the floor for debate on the floor. But of course, the Democrats control it, and they always write this stuff to make it look like, there really are changes. There are real important reform changes in this bill that gets around that addresses the problems that got us into the mess we're dealing with now. But I swear to God, I'm no expert on this stuff. I'm certainly no great financial analyst. But just looking at what I've been going through from a common sense point of view, it looks like old wine and new bottles. I mean, the Fed will come out of this, if this passes, with more power than ever. So what are we doing? We're letting the Fed, a private banking cartel, regulate other banks with $50 billion or more in assets. What kind of reform is that?
Right. That's why we have to get our banking system back into the state. Well, we have to get everything back to the local community where we have control over what's going on.
Oh, absolutely. I am a great believer in community, local empowerment, and there still is a 10th Amendment in the Constitution. You never know it the way things are run, especially the fact that the states don't balk at a lot of stuff. Oh, they may do it a little bit rhetorically, but they back off and they let the federal government pretty much do what they let the corporate interests do what they want. But if Washington wants something done like not really helping the states all that much with the terrible dilemma that they're going through right now, because the scheme very definitely is to force the states, and they're doing it, to slash budgets, to make the people take the pain. So it's being done at the federal level. It's being done at the state level. Mm-hmm. I'm still waiting, Ellen, to see what's going to happen in Illinois. It's great that there's at least a proposal for a state-owned bank in Illinois. I don't think it's going to go anywhere. I told you on another program, not that I expected a reply, of course, but I emailed my governor, and I explained to him in simple language a 10-year-old could understand the common sense merits of a state-owned bank. And that so-and-so never even answered me. He never even said thank you. And I think on a per capita basis, Illinois has a worse problem than California. We have a gaping budget hole. Illinois is a much smaller state than California, and I think that the hole is about $9 billion. And they always play the game the same way, Ellen, budget resolutions. I forget the exact date. I think it runs close to mid-year. They let the clock run out and go into overtime. Mm-hmm. This is the game they play whenever they can't resolve a budget situation. So they literally do that. And then in the end, they come up with some jerry-rigged solution. And there's no question how it's going to be. The people in the state are going to take the pain. It's just a question of what they're going to enact. I'm for certain there'll be a state tax increase. The talk is we get off much easier than you do in California. We have a flat 3% rate for everybody. I think for certain it's going up to 5%, maybe more. But they're talking about a lot of other things as well. And then they've already done some things. They've hit the universities. I don't know if they made students pay more tuition, but the schools in turn will do that. So the people are taking the pain instead of doing the right thing and nobody having to take the pain. That's the kind of government we live under at the state and the federal level. And my feeling all along, Ellen, I always say this, say it in my writing, say it on air, unless we the people on our own grassroots make enough effort to change things, they won't get better. They'll just get progressively worse.
Mm-hmm.
Any disagreement with that, Ellen?
No. It seems to me the problem is that we've been brainwashed. We don't understand what our money system's all about, and that's why it took me a whole book to explain this. People want it in one page, and it's just very difficult to do in one page because we've got a whole education system that has taught us that things are one way when they're actually another way completely. We've been taught and that we believe that our money is issued by the government, that the government is at fault here, that if we allow the government to issue more money, that will just inflate the system, that we have this huge federal debt, $12 trillion, that we're imposing on our children, and we have to do something about the federal debt, so we have to tighten our belts, cut services, privatize everything in order to pay off this debt, which is absolutely not true. The federal debt is our money supply. There is no money in our money system except money created by banks. It's all debt. All of our money is debt. And the public debt has shrunk because of this the collapse of the housing market. It used to be that banks would, banks have a capital requirement imposed from abroad. $8 of capital will get you $100 in loans, or allows you to create $100 in loans. And if it's mortgage-backed, then $4 in capital allows you to create $100 in loans. So banks were creating the $100, lending it to homeowners, and then they would bundle up all those loans in securities, sell them off to investors, and then they would make another $100 worth of loans with the same capital, and then another $100 worth of loans. Well, that whole boondoggle collapsed when the investors realized they were being sold all this dodgy subprime mortgages. They were sold as AAA because they were supposedly wrapped in these credit default swaps, which were derivatives, which would supposedly protect them against default. In other words, if they went into default, the sellers of the credit default swaps would bear the loss. But when, in fact, nobody was checking to see if the counterparties in those deals, the parties on the other side of the trade, actually had the money, which they didn't. So when they started going bankrupt, these hedge funds that were the counterparties to the credit default swaps, that was in the summer of 2007, that's when that whole collateralized debt obligation market, these were the mortgage-backed securities wrapped in derivatives, that whole market collapsed. So now banks can't do that anymore. They can't sell off their loans, so they're stuck with the loans they've got. So they can only do it once. $4 of capital will get you $100 in loans, and that's it. Meanwhile, their $100 in loans are going bad. So I saw a complaint, for instance, from the Michigan Banking Commissioner. Michigan's one of the states that's seriously exploring a state-owned bank, and I suspect they will be the first to do it because they are really desperate. People are leaving the state in droves. It's not that they don't have the money to buy homes. There's nobody to buy the homes, because nobody wants those homes because there are no jobs in Michigan anymore. I mean, it really is a third world. Well, Detroit, I understand, it looks like a war zone in parts of it, or at least like bad parts of a third world country, third world city, which is too bad. I grew up in that city, and it was great when I grew up, so I feel very
attached
to that.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't realize you grew up in Detroit. In my business, I used to have a regular event take place in Detroit, not downtown, in a suburban location that looks so different from the downtown area, Ellen. One time I had an event downtown, and it was like going from one world to another. But I once wrote about Detroit some weeks back, well, I think it's probably a few months back now, and the conservative unemployment figure in Detroit is 50%, and probably the true figure may be a good bit higher than that. I mean, you know, I mean, conservatively, half the working population of that city can't find a job because there are no jobs. Mm-hmm. And Detroit, my God, you go back enough years, go back 40, 50 years. I mean, Detroit was a booming metropolis, and now people moving out in droves. It's an empty shell. But to me, Detroit is a metaphor for what will be happening to a lot of other places around the country that simply won't be the way they once were. All because of bad policy. We're literally hollowing out America bit by bit by bit. And another one of my guests, Catherine Austin Fitz, writes about former high-level insider, government and business, Wall Street. She talks about the big boys having given up on America. They're just sucking all the worth out of it, all they can. And at some point in the future, they'll just dump this empty hulk and walk away and suck the worth out of some other host.
Mm-hmm. it's the parasitic nature of our money system. I mean, it has to work that way. That in order to keep the bubble going, they have to keep exploiting and exploiting. We have to change the system. It wouldn't, even if we locked up all the crooks, it wouldn't solve the problem, because the system itself is a parasite. Our money system is parasitic. And so we have to get it back to being self-sustaining, something that feeds us instead of us feeding it. Instead of it feeding off of us, it should be working for us. Money is merely a medium of exchange. It's merely a series of legal agreements between people. It's all based on credit. All money comes from credit. So it's all people saying, I don't have the money now, but let me, trust me, to use your goods and services to build something, and I'll pay you back in the future out of the proceeds. That's actually what the American dream is. That's where what made America great. That's the land of opportunity. The reason you have opportunity is that you can borrow. You can do something on credit. Benjamin Franklin wrote about that. He said that this was a brilliant new idea in his time, that the government itself could issue loans of this paper money that, you know, now he called it money, but I would call it credit, that people who didn't have anything but that could borrow at a reasonable interest would then be able to go out and build something, and then they could pay back the loan. That was a great concept. Instead of thinking that you had to have the money first, which is what many people even today think, that you've got to work hard and save the money instead of borrowing. We shouldn't be borrowing. But borrowing is actually a good thing. It's just credit. It's just developing your potential and paying back what you used from the thing that you made.
And you can just create it out of thin air. Every time a bank makes a loan, I know for ordinary mortals, and I'm certainly one of them, Ellen, but you've taught me so much. When a bank makes a loan, it's creating money. Money is created when credit is issued, and money is destroyed when loans are paid off and not renewed in equal amounts. So right now we see credit deflating drastically. I read economist David Rosenberg's daily weekday columns. He just writes great stuff. He tells it the way it should be told. No monkey business. He explains the problems going on. He talks about we're deflating debt at record levels. I mean, we're at a pace that surpasses the Great Depression. I mean, sooner or later, you would think that this would take effect. But what's happening is the big banks, small banks, I guess, are making some loans, but not a lot. I have a neighbor in my building who started a small business, and he complains that he can't get a bank credit. He can't go to a bank and get a loan from them. So the big banks are using their money to speculate, operating as casinos, not as banks. And loans are being repaid, and they're not being reissued. So credit keeps deflating, deflating, and deflating. I'm just wondering when push will come to shove and something awful is going to happen. I guess this can go on for a long time, Ellen, before we really see some terrible things happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, this banking commissioner was complaining about, he pointed out that, say you have, it's the way the banking rules are set up, that you could have credit flowing. And, of course, you can have credit flowing if you have a state-owned bank, a publicly owned bank that has lots of capital and lots of deposits. But so he was complaining, the way it works is, say in Detroit, you had a house that was valued at $100,000. And so that is an asset on the books of the bank. Now that loan goes into default, the bank is required to value that because of the mark-to-market rule that was imposed by the Bank for International Settlements, a foreign central banking power that's imposing their rules on us. Because of that rule, the bank now has to value that piece of real estate at $10,000 because the other houses in the neighborhood aren't selling, and the last house that sold for $10,000. So suddenly the bank has lost a $90,000 worth of asset, and because they can leverage their money, $100,000 in asset used to be good for $1 million in loans. Well, now they've got to reduce their asset base by $90,000, so they've just lost the potential to make $900,000 in loans. So they can't lend because of the mark-to-market rule, which has shrunk their assets. You know, because the assets are supposedly not worth what they were, but they actually are. As he points out, and he had a couple of cases where although the loan was in delinquent, the people couldn't afford to pay the interest, but they were paying the principal. They were still paying, and that the projection was that if you let the people stay there, they would pay $80,000 over the life of the loan. So it was really worth $80,000. It was still a paying loan, even though it wasn't paying the full amount. And there was another case where they had a buyer who was willing to pay something like $80,000 on the house. So it really was still a viable loan, or the buyer was willing to, I guess, to take over the mortgage, and so he would be paying that sum. So these properties really aren't worth that little amount that they have to be valued at. So he's just saying the rules are wrong. If we change the banking rules, I also read an article by some bankers in San Diego who were saying the same thing, that the rules are wrong, that they aren't allowed to value, they aren't allowed to issue the credit that they could issue. If they were freed up to issue credit, then we could get things moving again. Well, the reason a state-owned bank could get things moving again is because they have a huge capital base and a huge potential deposit base. I would argue here, I haven't written this article yet, I want to get to it, but that what they should use for their capital, or could use, is those, all that money that Walter Burian keeps writing about. Every state has huge amounts of money socked away in investments, but they can't touch it for their budgets. This is the money, you can see it in their comprehensive annual financial reports, or CAFRs. And for instance, in California, the treasurer is managing, I believe it's $70 billion in these investments. We're like $20 billion in the red, but the governor can't touch that $70 billion. It's just sitting there drawing a little interest. And the reason is it's in all these various funds. So, for instance, the highway fund, or the different counties have their own funds. All these different little groups have their own bits of money invested somewhere. So the governor tried to get the highway fund money, and there was a lawsuit brought, and the judge said, no, you can't touch that money. The taxpayers paid that. There was a bond issue for highways, and they paid that money thinking it was going to highways, and so you can't use it for your state budget. And, in fact, when he tried to do it, of course, there was all these complaints. Now we're going to have bad highways because the governor's stealing our highway money. But they weren't using it for highways. It's just sitting there drawing interest. So what I would argue is that they could take that money without spending it. So right now, let's say it's invested in some Wall Street bonds, some Wall Street CDs or whatever. It's drawing an average of 4.3% interest. So you take those bonds that it's currently invested in, you pledge them as the capital for your state-owned bank. You don't have to liquidate the bonds. You just pledge them as capital. And because he's got $70 billion there, I mean, you could just pledge like $10 billion of that money. If anybody needed their money out, any of those funds, then the other people whose money is in that investment pool that he manages would be happy to jump over, because let's say the state bank gave him a little extra, so they're drawing 4% on their CD, and then say the state-owned bank agreed to pay an extra 1% dividends on this equity that they're going to be holding in the state-owned bank. So now they're making 5%. So they're going to like that. It's a better deal. They'll do it. And it's pretty much risk-free because they can get out of it when they need to. And the only time that capital would be hit up would be if the whole state went bankrupt. And there's no reason for California to go bankrupt. It's the world's eighth largest economy. We've got resources. We've got people. The only thing we're missing is credit. So if you get the credit machine going, we're not going bankrupt. And, in fact, we've never defaulted on any debt. That's another one of these Wall Street rackets where they've characterized the California's bonds at, I think they're BBB rated because they're so far in the red, and yet they've never defaulted on anything. They really should still be AAA. But because they're BBB, that means that they can jack up the interest rates on them.
Oh, your plan sounds so sensible. Will you please hurry up and write that article? I want to read it.
It's a little bit tricky. That one's a hard one to write.
Helen, it's amazing how there are solutions to the stuff we're going through right now, but the politicians are mucking it all up. They simply won't take the solutions, and they have to have a few smart people around like you who know the right things to do. They're not listening, or maybe they're listening and they don't care.
I think they might be listening a little, because that's what I mean. I was so amazed to watch these five states that suddenly have bills pending. Where did that come from?
The train in the station is at least coughing. It may not be moving, but it's coughing. Ellen, let's take a quick break at the bottom of the hour, and you can grab another cup of coffee, and we'll come back in a couple of minutes. At the end of that first hour that was a repeat that I had no idea would be replaying, I mentioned that I, honest to goodness, have no doubt that one of the, I know there are lots of grand schemes, but I think one of the real big ones is to literally destroy entirely Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. And there's a wonderful website that anybody can go to. It's usdebtclock.org. It's a blizzard of numbers, but if you look down at the bottom, my desktop is acting up. Anyway, if you look down at the bottom, you'll see a gargantuan U.S. unfunded total liabilities for Medicare, Social Security, and prescription drug benefits. Believe it or not, the prescription drug liability, that's Medicare Part D for people like me, except I'm no liability because I refuse to take Part D. It's a scam, at least for people like me. But the prescription drug liability, amazingly, Ellen, is a greater unfunded liability than Social Security. Can you believe that? But the big one, well, if you put prescriptions and Medicare together, that's the big kahuna. And the grand total, not including Medicaid, right now is $118 trillion, I mean, it's such a blizzard of numbers, I can't read the damn thing, over $108 trillion in unfunded liabilities, or a per-person in the country liability of nearly $350,000. Ellen, you, me, everybody listening, we're in hoc for $350,000, I hope I didn't say million, $350,000 because of these unfunded liabilities. And the reason Medicaid has no unfunded one is because there's no trust fund for Medicaid. It's federal and state general revenues that go to pay Medicaid, and I guess if the states and the federal government decide they don't want to pay it anymore, then there's no more Medicaid. Well, the feds are putting a greater squeeze on the states to pay more, so the feds pay less, but the feds can't afford it, so one of the cuts they're making is to Medicaid. Well, I'm sure that Washington wants them to cut Medicaid because those people are the most vulnerable. They don't have a lobby serving them. So they're getting slowly squeezed out, and then the grand plan is to get rid of the rest. You get rid of those unfunded liabilities, and all the rest of them hardly matter. But all the rest of them will come too. I'm convinced that's part of the scheme to destroy social America. I just hope I don't live long enough to see it, Ellen.
Well, I'm more of a Pollyanna than you.
but I hope you're right and I'm wrong.
It seems to me that it's just our way of doing things, so we have to fail first. Like with this banking scheme, the bankers got in there and bailed out their banks, and now it's so obvious to everybody that we have this Tea Party movement, et cetera. I mean, people are outraged. So that does get people organized, and they start thinking about it, and they start looking into things. I think, of course, my complaint with the whole medical system is I think our medicine is wrong. We simply can't afford it because it's the wrong approach. I mean, it's not curing people, and that's why it's so incredibly expensive.
It sure
in
is
fact,
the wrong approach.
Real cure, sorry?
Go ahead.
Real cure is very cheap, actually. It starts with education. You got to know how your body works, and you got to know what went wrong here. I blame toxins for practically everything. So if you get those toxins out of there, which there are ways to eliminate toxins from the body. So it's the opposite of what the drug approach is, to put more toxins in there. Those drugs are toxic. There are no drugs that are not toxic by definition, because you can't patent a drug unless you've altered the molecules. Like, you can't patent it if it's strictly a natural thing. Although I guess they're sort of creeping into that now. But technically, a patentable thing is something where you've changed the structure. So that means it's not what your body wants. You're taking in something that's going to screw up the way your body works. So we have to get back to nature. I mean, we need to sweat that junk out get that stuff out various ways and take in those nutrients that we actually need, real nutrients. And those are the things that that they downplay in the whole medical business, because they want your business. I mean, it's all because it's profit driven. That's what's wrong here. That if you don't have, well, I was speaking to a doctor from Russia, and she said that they had no money, and they had this socialized system where they had to get people well, so they had to look for the things that actually worked, because it wasn't going to do them any good to be doing expensive treatments that didn't work. And therefore the Russians developed a number of really good natural effective things that we're not looking for. Those things, I know somebody who he's a chiropractor, but he had a friend who had this great remedy that he was sure would work, and he went to a drug man and said, you should develop this product. I can't even remember what the condition was, but anyway, this works, you know, it'll cure the condition. And the drug man said, well, it's a good idea. He said, but you know, we won't develop it. And the man said, why not? And he said, well, we can't make any money off of that. We're a business.
Oh, for sure. And overall, for the healthcare, the so-called healthcare industry to work, the one thing that that they would fear the most, if there was a possibility, would be healthy people. Even the insurers, Ellen, need sick people. I mean, if people didn't get sick,
right,
they
sick
wouldn't
people
need
are their
insurance.
That's their market. They've got to have sick people. Right.
They got to have sick people, and they have people scared that they'll have a catastrophic illness, and they have to buy these damn insurance policies. And then if they have a catastrophic illness, the insurers will game the system to obstruct, to delay, and to deny to every extent possible. You get into their denial process, and they'll chew you up and spit you out. What power do we have against those guys?
Mm-hmm. And what they want is just that other 30 million people who, to pay insurance. I mean, they want the money because the insurance people are the bankers now. Since they got rid of Glass-Steagall, all those insurance premiums go into funds somewhere, and fund managers manage them, invest them. So that's more money for the Wall Street bankers, and then they can use that money and leverage it into yet more money. So it's just feeding that same banking parasite that has to keep eating, or it'll collapse. I saw recently that J.P. Morgan is going to make a bunch of money off of WaMu, Washington Mutual, and of course the shareholders get nothing. And J.P. Morgan, it's just one more thing that J.P. Morgan has eaten up to its advantage. They're making billions of dollars out of the deal, just as they ate up Bear Stearns and made billions of dollars out of the deal.
Oh, absolutely, and Lehman and Merrill Lynch and Wall Street eats its own. The powerful eat the less powerful,
mm-hmm.
so that the survivors become more powerful than ever. And it's a revolving cycle, Ellen. And again, the financial reform that the Senate will now debate and whatever they come up with, I swear to God, I think this is just this what they'll probably come up with something and pass it. But what it really will be, it'll be more empowerment to the giant banks and financial institutions to keep doing what they've been doing before, to produce the next crisis, to remove more competition, to buy assets on the cheap, to get more bailouts if they need it, to suck our money into their pockets. It's a dirty system. What an argument for making banking, for just wiping the slate clean. This is why I love this. So I love banking as a public utility. I think you like that idea as well.
Oh yeah. Mhm. That would
I mean
be
literally make it a public utility. Let's get the private banks had it all these years. My God, they've had it since the beginning. And mm-hmm. they've done nothing but screw the whole system up, especially since the Fed came into existence, the end of 1913. I think it's the number now. I think it's 19 or 20 recessions. We have the Great Depression. We have one crash after another. We have the big banks are getting stronger and stronger. We get people being more and more hurt. Haven't they proved to everybody that they simply cannot get it right? And the real – they're a cancer. When you have
exactly.
a cancer, you've got to get rid of it.
Right.
Chemotherapy won't work. We need to get in there, and we need to excise this son of a gun
right.
and bury it.
I agree. Yeah.
Let's. My God, when people say, "Well, you know, government can't do what private entrepreneurs can do," they have an incentive. Yeah, they have an incentive to steal our money and enrich themselves. Let's give the government a chance.
Yeah.
We don't have to give them a century to prove it. Let's give them a decade and see how well they do. There is no doubt in our minds, Ellen, that they will outdistance the privateers. And,
yeah, that's why I like the state-owned bank idea, because they can just start doing it. They don't have to get Congress to approve, and they don't have to fight anyone in Congress. They can just do it, and who can say they can't do it? If private bankers can set up a bank, surely a public entity can set up a bank. They're just setting up a bank. It's so simple.
It really. You know what my analogy is to that? I mean that really is the answer. If enough of the states did this, especially a couple of big ones, California. Oh my God! If California, Illinois, New York did it, I think it would start an avalanche getting the other ones to do it, because the good results would start showing up. To me, the analogy is how to get rid of the corporate media. Just such a simple strategy they have no defense against. Stop watching them. Stop reading them. If they lose their audience, they lose their viability. It's not a damn thing. They can't force us to tune in. They can't force us to buy their newspapers to tell us nothing, their magazines to tell us nothing. Just opt out. So if the states opted out of the corrupted federal system, the Fed would just crumble like a house of cards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, close enough to it, Ellen. Close enough to it.
Yeah. Well, on the education bill, which I think, or the student loan bill, which I think is the one good thing that came out of the health bill, is they've had 45 years of experimenting here with a public-private situation where the loans, they were private loans, in other words, created on the books of private banks but guaranteed by the government. So the banks can't lose. The justification for allowing a bank to collect interest, even if they admit that they're just creating credit on their books, is that, well, the loan might go bad, and even though they've just extended credit, if the borrower doesn't repay the loan, then they're still on the hook for, they have to balance their books, so they still could go bankrupt. But if the government guarantees the loan, they're not on the hook for anything. So there's no justification for these middlemen to be getting interest. And worse than that, they weren't just getting ordinary interest. They're manipulating it so that they make huge amounts of interest when a student defaults. I mean, they make more interest when students default, and therefore they like the bad debts. It encourages bad debts. There was a study where I think it was a 7.2, maybe a 7.4% default rate for the private bank program. Student loans versus 4.8%. I'm not sure about the figures, but it's 4.something% for the maybe it's 4.2% for the government direct lending program. So somehow the private lenders are encouraging defaults. They like defaults. So it's just a bad deal all around. And for years, many studies have shown that it would be a better deal for the government to just, and for the borrowers, for the students, for them to just lend the money directly. And so finally they're doing it. They were up to 80% of student loans anyway were government loans. So finally they've gotten rid of the other 20% and they've just cut out the middlemen. But the interesting thing to me is this, although they're not calling it a bank, they are literally now in the banking business. They are, I guess the education department will get the money for 2-point-something% from the Treasury, and then they'll be lending at 6-point-something%. So they get that 4% spread, and that money will go to Pell Grants and to, you know, to for grants for people who can't afford university.
You know, I noticed that 2.8% in your article. Why is it that when the funds rate, the Fed funds rate, is essentially zero or 0.25%, why didn't they make the rate lower than 2.8 and loan it out for a lower amount? I mean, do they want to act a little bit like the private bankers and make a few extra bucks?
Well, the Treasury is giving it to them. Now, where does the Treasury get the money? That's the Treasury can't create the money. They should be able to, but they can't. So my hopefully what they could do, if they set up a bank, then they're allowed to act like a bank, which means they will get it at the Fed funds rate. If they act like the Treasury, then they have to issue bonds, which means they get it at the rate the bonds go for, which is a higher rate. In other words, the Treasury itself can get money a lot cheaper if it acts like a bank. John Stewart did a really clever thing recently, I don't know if you saw it, where he was saying now that corporations get to be people, he thought people should get to be corporations. So now it was John Stewart, the corporation, was that he was going to take his junky car and call that, he had his own rating agency, and so his rater came in and said, oh yeah, that car's worth $3 million. And so John Stewart says, well, see there, it's good collateral for my $1 million loan here that I want. And I'll be paying you 0% interest because I'm going to get it at the Fed funds rate because I'm now a bank.
I like the idea of you and I setting ourselves up as a bank so we can go to the Fed window and get that 0% interest.
Yeah, well, that's what the state-owned banks could do, or that's what this education bank could do if they set it up as a bank. And there is precedent that the Green Bank, which is part of the energy bill, it is calling itself a bank, and the proposal is that they will be able to leverage their money like any bank does. So they will start with, I think it was $5 billion, and it would go increase to $50 billion over 5 years. This would be the the actual investment that would come from the government. And then they could leverage that into $500 billion in loans because they're a bank. If they're not a bank, they don't get the leverage. So the education department should also become a bank, and they can do the very same thing.
Imagine if we ever had a government that really was a government of the people, by the people, for the people. And there is in the Constitution, I like to quote it every now and then. Oh, I forget the, I think it's Article 1, it might be Section 8, the so-called General Welfare Clause, where government, at least as written in the Constitution, is supposed to serve the general welfare of the people.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd never know it because it never has done it. I mean, the founders wrote that thing in the Constitution. They never did it. They actually never did it. So I guess how could you expect the kind of government we have now to do it? That basically is just completely ignored. And the first three words of the Constitution in the preamble are, "We the people."
Mm-hmm. To provide
what a charade.
Yeah.
We the people. No definition on what they mean by we the people. It sure is not you and me, Ellen. That's for sure. I guess it means them, not us.
Mm-hmm.
But those words are there. Anybody can look up the preamble. The first words are we the people.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, we should need it.
How do we get it back? I mean, there's so many corrupt things going on. You can just see them happening. But who's going to enforce these? How do we get the power? We can complain all we want. I think they let us write articles, you know, and moan and groan. And it's like the 9/11 truthers, you know, they let them demonstrate, but nothing ever happens. It's just kind of letting us let off a little steam because we don't have the leverage ourselves. We don't have the power. So that's why it seems to me that the states need to just take off and do it.
Well, you're right,
Ellen.
They
do have the power.
There have only been a few times in the history of this country where people power made the difference, but it didn't happen easily or overnight. Just for women to get the right to vote, Ellen, I mean, imagine the founders. Jefferson was not one. He was overseas as an ambassador to France. But Washington and Madison were the two best-known ones. Madison, a fairly unknown at the time. The only larger-than-life figure in Philadelphia in 1786 was George Washington. And if he hadn't been there, the whole thing might have never come together. But they literally wrote women out of the Constitution. They just looked at women as an appendage of men, not eligible for any rights, so they did not have the right to vote. And it took until 1920, the 19th Amendment or so, before women actually got the right to vote. But the suffragettes, they fought for 100 years to get this, and they endured pain along the way. I mean, they got arrested. I think probably you get out in the street and start protesting enough, the police beat you. They don't care if you're a man, woman, or child. They'll just start beating you. They might even shoot you. And they went through all that pain for all that time just to get the right to vote. And today, when we think of the right to vote, I mean, I understand what the right to vote means. It doesn't mean a damn thing because there's no choice. And then you've got corporate-run electronic voting machines to do the counting. So in the immortal words of...
...program did not necessarily...
...a web editor angry at me. He did not like posting an article of mine with a quote from Joseph Stalin in it. But the quote was something, his quote on voting. It's not who casts the votes that matters. It's who counts them.
Mm-hmm.
And that sure is right. So women may have the right to vote. I may have the right to vote. But you and I don't get the right to count those votes. That's what really matters. Or to choose the candidates to vote for.
Yeah. Well, there's been a movement for money reform since the 1890s, or before that, actually, that we're campaigning for the same thing that we're campaigning for now. Supposedly, the prototype of Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz was this woman named Mary Ellen Leese, and she was a great speaker, and she said, Wall Street owns the country. I mean, she said that 100 years ago, Wall Street owns the country. They still own it. But maybe, hopefully, that we've come to the end of the line in their great pyramid scheme. There's no way that we can keep a quadrillion-dollar derivatives bubble going. I mean, that thing has to collapse. It might be disastrous, but we have to be at the end of the line here, it seems to me. That now we're at the point in history where we really do have to change things, and hopefully we really can change things.
Well, we really can change. I honestly believe it because I know enough about the history. I'm not a historian. I'm not an expert. But I do know enough about the history, and I read a wonderful book called Challenging Authority by Frances Fox Pippen, and I once had her on this program talking about it. We're a few times in history, we really got important change because people forced it. The government never gives it to you. It never comes from the top down. I say that over and over again in this program. It only comes from the bottom up, from the grassroots. And it's happened some momentous times, civil rights, women's suffrage, the labor movement. I mean, this is big stuff. But it took a lot of pain. People suffered to get it. They put their bodies on the line, and they finally got results. But Frances, in her book, makes the punchline conclusion. That even after you win these great things, you'll lose them if you don't keep fighting for them. And look at civil rights. What was won in the 1960s, it's all gone now. It's all gone. I'm waiting for another eruption for people finally to realize it and say, oh, my God, all that bloodshed for what happened in the 60s, and it's all disappeared now. Racism is as virulent now as it ever was. The right to vote doesn't exist because of the way the system is jerry-rigged, and on and on and on and on. But it's the rest of us, too. It's not just the right to vote. It's everything. We literally our rights are being stripped away until there's nothing left. And if we don't fight back to change it, there will be nothing for us. It's why I, honest to goodness, say, Ellen, this country is not a fit place to live in for most of us. It, honest to goodness, is not a fit place to live in. But we can make it a fit place again.
Do I have time for one more comment?
Yeah.
I hear your music. In one more article I want to write that I haven't gotten to, the Tea Party people, we know what they're against, and they are organizing, but you know what the original Tea Party was about? The Boston Tea Party was actually about getting back to the power to create our own money, and that, it seems to me, could be an organizing thing that could actually get a grassroots movement going. That, like you say, we've been fighting for 200 years for that. We didn't even realize that we lost it. But when the Boston Tea Party was not just about the fact that they were imposing a little tax on tea, according to various historians, Benjamin Franklin is alleged to have said that, but that may be apocryphal. But anyway, the problem was that we were forced to pay this tax in a currency that we didn't have control over. They didn't allow us to issue our own scrip, the colonies, so the colonies had to borrow Bank of England banknotes, which were supposedly backed by gold, but they weren't. They were fraudulent. There were 9 out of 10 notes. There was no gold behind them because of the fractional reserve system. So
explained lucidly in Web of Debt, why people have to go out and buy your book. Oh, we'll keep talking about it. We'll talk about it more next. Oh, we're out of time.
Okay,
unless the next host wants to cede the hour to us, we could just keep this thing going all afternoon, right?
No.
Well, you will be back next month. We'll have another round. Oh, it was a wonderful hour, Ellen. I hate to bring it to an end, but
very
the clock has expired. I'll let you go. My great thanks to you. You can grab another cup of coffee. I'll grab some lunch and finish up doing some banker bashing, one of my favorite things like yours.
Thanks,
Ellen. I look forward to next time. And join us again next week, Thursdays, Saturdays, and Sundays. Thursdays at 11 a.m., weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.
This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.